A third part of the interview with Jack Nicklaus by William Burr took place in Oakland, California on June 21st, 1988.
Okay, now in March 1975, the Shah visited Washington to meet with President Ford and other policymakers. And during the visit, the Shah met with Defense Secretary James Schlesinger and brought up the possibility of buying Boeing 707s with AWACS systems. I think this is the first time the question of AWACS is brought up by the Shah with the U.S. Government. Now, do you recall how this question was handled at the embassy? Because you were DCM at this point, 75. Whether the question of AWACS is brought up in embassy discussions, or discussion between Ambassador Helms and the Shah around this time?
I don't remember sequence of how this question arose. Mm. I do recall, however, that there was a discussion, ongoing discussion, about the best way of providing Iran with an air defense radar capability. And at one point early on, certainly before the AWACS question developed, there was a plan to, or proposal I should say, to create a circle of radar stations, land-based radar stations, virtually around the entire perimeter of Iran, which on closer examination proved that it would be really infeasible, both from an expense point of view as well as from a manning and maintenance point of view. I suppose that AWACS technology had progressed to the point where this loomed larger and larger as a viable alternative. Now, whether we raise this with the Shah or the Shah raised this with us, because as you remember, he was very knowledgeable about defense matters and technology and the latest developments in technology, I really don't know, but it arose from those basic considerations of a radar defense capability and the most feasible, viable solution to what was seen as a problem.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall how far the discussions over the AWACS as such went under the Ford administration? Whether there's any tentative agreement that the Shah could buy them or would buy them? I know it was decided under Carter that he could have access to them. Was there any
No, question? I don't remember whether
there
was or not.
Okay. Now another issue came up a few months earlier in October 74 when Kissinger visited Iran to discuss oil price questions among other things. And before Kissinger left, Clark McGregor, United Aircraft, wrote to Kissinger about the proposals for helicopter co-production, in which United Technologies, Boeing, and Bell Helicopter are all competing for the contract for co-production of helicopters. And McGregor was worried, according to this letter, he was worried that Bell Helicopter had a political edge over United Technologies. And he asked Kissinger, who was about to visit the Shah, to let the Shah know that the U.S. supported the idea of equal opportunity. That is, the U.S. had no preference over any of these companies as to who would get the contract with the Shah. Did this question come to your attention while you were in Tehran?
No. To say that Bell Helicopter had a, quote, political edge, unquote, I don't know whether that would be an accurate description or not. It may be that they had some preference in Iranian eyes because, as you know, they were buying hundreds of Bell helicopters. Mm-hmm. Some of them, if not all of them, produced in Italy at one point. Then co-production was a thought that was brought into almost every question of military equipment procurement versus a transition to co-production or simply in-country production per se. So I'm not surprised that competitors would suggest that for one reason or another that Iran should be politically neutral. I mean that the United States should be politically neutral or even economically neutral in suggesting one company or another. But this is the kind of thing that I think came up all the time, not just specifically this instance or this company. Mm-hmm. But back to your original question, did it come to my attention? If it did, it didn't loom large in my memory.
Okay. Well, sometime later, back in April 76, Henry Kissinger visited the Shah again at the Shah's summer palace by the Caspian Sea, I think. And there they announced a plan for $10 billion in arms sales. It would be part of a $50 billion package that would be in effect through from 76 through 1980, in those 4 years. Do you know how these arms sales packages were put together? They talk about $50 billion package for 4 years, and how was this number? How was the kind of a package put together, and that kind of a number reached?
Well, it had always been our contention, and with the Iranian agreement, that the only way to develop and maintain a military defense system would be to do it on a multi-year basis. Mm-hmm. So that when you talk about projecting out over to 1980 or whatever it might have been, that was consistent with the idea of multi-year mm-hmm. planning. Mm-hmm. Insofar as the content of any particular plan was concerned, this was something that the Iranians themselves developed, very much like our own military developed their plans and project them out in terms of equipment purchases and costs and all the rest of it. I mean, this is part of the systematic planning program. I don't recall these precise figures or even the content of such a plan, but yes, the concept is certainly a valid one, and one that was followed.
Do you recall anything about Kissinger's visit in particular? Was it the decision to announce? Was this announcement of this package the main reason for his visit, or was that just sort of incident to it?
I recall the visit, but I don't recall that this was the centerpiece of it, or whether it was simply a convenient timing or whatever.
Okay. Now, how much contact did you have with General Hassan Tufanian, who handled arms sales negotiations for the Shah? How much interaction did you have with him?
Not on a regular basis. Of course, I knew General Tufanian and saw him professionally several times, socially several times. But Henry Preck, who was our political military man in the embassy, saw Tufanian a great deal. Mm-hmm. And in coordination with the MAG, dealt with him.
Mm-hmm. Did you pick up any impressions of Tufanian?
In what way?
What kind of, how would you assess him as a negotiator or?
Oh, he is a shrewd, intelligent man who obviously enjoyed the Shah's trust. He was, as we all know, his principal arms procurement man and negotiator. And he was a very good negotiator. He, certain that many American company representatives would testify to that.
Now, over the years of the conflicting reports, as to whether Tufani personally benefited from the arms sales that he negotiated, how much merit do you think those allegations have had?
Well, let me just say, General Tufani did not leave Iran a poor man.
Mm-hmm. Nothing came to your attention that would suggest to get proof of the story.
There were allegations of one sort or another, not just with reference to American companies, but other companies as well, other countries, but certainly nothing was ever hard, factual information or stories. In hindsight, you just have to wonder where his means today come from.
Other testimony was from the Shah, basically. The Shah took care of him. Which is maybe an alternative explanation, but I don't know.
I suppose.
I don't know.
Yes, I don't either. Yeah. I don't either.
Okay. Now, at our last meeting, I asked you about the U.S. Special Defense Representative to Iran, Eric von Morbode, and his efforts to systematize the Shah's arms purchases. Now, what impact did von Morbode's presence have on the stature of Armistice Schmeg, the stature of the Armistice Schmeg chief? Was there an adverse impact on the status of Armistice because of the Special Defense Representative's presence in Tehran, sort of giving an overall perspective to the arms sales transactions that were going on?
In the eyes of the Iranians
or the U.S.?
Or the U.S. Or
either way, actually.
Well, certainly insofar as we were concerned in the embassy, and I suppose back in Washington, there were two separate distinct jobs. There was a feeling that in Department of Defense, as we know, and Schlesinger in particular, as I recall, that the Iranian military purchase program was getting out of hand, and that they weren't getting the best information that they could, that American companies were coming over there, and naturally they were putting the best possible face on whatever proposal they might be making, and that some objective input was a desirable thing, and that the MAG chief was not necessarily a technically competent source of information for this, so that Eric's job was to fill that gap, that perceived gap, which did not diminish the role of the MAG chief. And I don't think that it did insofar as the Iranian military. Now, insofar as, say, relationship with General Tufanian was concerned, yes, that Tufanian might well expect to get information that he hadn't gotten before from Eric and not from the MAG chief. But he still dealt with both. I mean, one wasn't cut out because of the other, or vice versa.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, in the mid-70s, Richard Secor was the chief U.S. Air Force official. with Armish Meg. Did you have much contact with C-Corp at this stage?
Oh, yes, I knew Dick quite well. Dick was originally there as a colonel. I guess he was number two or something like that in the section airs,
something like that.
Something like that. But at the time impressed me as a very bright, personable officer. I carry that impression to this day. He was very able. I can't comment on, you know, later events in life because I don't know, but certainly my association with him and his performance there was outstanding in every way.
Okay. From what I've read, General Robert Heiser, who at this stage was with the U.S. was with the U.S. European Command, had been a frequent visitor to Aransas in the 1960s. Did you meet him on any of his visits, or?
Yes, I met him several times.
Did you get to know him very well, or?
No.
Did you get a sense of what the purposes of his visits were? What he was there for?
Well, I don't think that it was a very narrowly focused mission. It was more in the context of his area-wide command responsibilities. To be knowledgeable about what was going on in that, in his area-wide command, and part of it was visiting around. This went on all the time. I mean, not just with Heiser, but with
a lot of generals. Okay. Now, during the mid-1970s, the State Department's Inspector General prepared several reports on the U.S. mission, U.S. Embassy in Iran, evaluated the embassy and its job and its responsibilities, and made suggestions for internal reform. In this 1974 report, the IG noted that the State Department wanted information on the political views of the military leadership of Iran. And the report noted that Armish Meg was not forthcoming in providing information on the political views and the various personnel that made up the Iranian high command. Did this situation change much when you were DCM in Tehran? Did Armish Meg become more forthcoming about providing information, or was it a constant kind of a problem?
It was an ongoing problem. I was constantly pushing for a better system of evaluating the Iranian military, their political orientation, their organization, and their loyalties, and for the obvious reasons. And we really just never got very far. And I pushed Henry Precht on this very hard, and every new MAG chief and deputy head of section that came in, I would talk to him about this. This was just a continuing effort on my part. We would get some information, but it wasn't systematic, it wasn't regular, and it certainly wasn't satisfactory from my point of view or the ambassador's point of view.
They give the standard response that this was not their business to provide intelligence? Was that their usual response? Or?
No, they didn't. Well, they didn't give me that response face to face, but certainly one got that feeling that, and to a certain extent, I can understand this thought entering their mind that we're not here to do this, that if we engage in this sort of, in effect, intelligence activity, that we can jeopardize our mission here, this is not the primary purpose, et cetera, et cetera. And we tried to think of ways that we could accommodate each other's felt needs. But as I say, in the end, it was never fully satisfactory by any stretch of the imagination.
Now, the 76 report by the IG recommended that the embassy analyze the economic impact of arms sales so that we have the ability to provide information to the Iranian government on the costs and economic implications of its various arms purchases. To what extent was this recommendation implemented? Was O'Hanley having any effectual work done as part of his job? Or
yes. Yeah. Well, Henry and the economic officers, the economic section, this is an enormous task. Just to collect reliable raw data before you even begin to make this kind of an analysis. If you were to do it right, you're really talking about staffing up the embassy with maybe 50 to 75 people who could go out and develop this information, and not an easy task in and of itself, and then to bring it in and do some kind of coherent analysis. Now, we all recognize that if this kind of analysis could be done, it would be very valuable, a very useful thing. But frankly, this is pie in the sky as far as I was concerned. Yes, we ought to make some effort to do so to the best that we could with limited resources available, etc., etc. But you could make some fairly broad, obvious statements, or reach some fairly broad, obvious conclusions, which we did, that if you were going to acquire X number of Iranian military battalions or divisions equipped with X type of equipment, that the drain on trained manpower would have an effect on the civilian economy. I mean, just by definition, there weren't that many educated, trained people in the country. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people, but not educated, trained people. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, to go very much further than that is very difficult.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, in the late 1960s, early 70s, the Shah raised in public, in the newspaper articles, in the New York Times, he also raised this question in private, the whole issue of the U.S. naval base in Bahrain. He argued against any military presence in the Persian Gulf by the big powers, Soviet Union or the U.S. Did the Shah bring this question up in private discussions, whether the U.S. should continue to maintain its small naval presence at Bahrain? Well, it's more of a statement for public consumption, perhaps. They may be statements about the big powers in the Gulf.
Well, I can't recall our ever really discussing this, or this ever really being a critical issue between Iran and the United States. It was a point that he made, obviously, it was in the New York Times, but I would have to say that if you wanted my impression, it was more for public consumption than he really was terribly serious about, although he did argue that in keeping with the Nixon doctrine and with Iran's own growing capabilities, that there would be less need than there might have been at one time for an outside military presence.
Okay. Now this is another another question that's come up over the years. It's been alleged from time to time that the Shah contributed to Richard Nixon's presidential campaigns during the late 60s, early 70s. Did you ever hear anything that would...
I've heard that story.
That would lend credence to that allegation?
No, I've heard the story. And, I mean, the Shah, when Nixon was out of power and traveling, I think, for Coca-Cola or but when he visited Tehran, why Nixon received him and paid attention to, I'm sorry, the Shah received Nixon and paid attention to him and that sort of thing. And I,
this is the early 60s. You're talking about after the presidency.
Yes. I mean, before he came back on the national scene, you might say. And that blew out my mind at that point. Left a favorable impression with Nixon. I mean, you know, he appreciated that. And as I said, the stories of the contribution floated around for years, but I have no evidence, I have no knowledge that this was ever in fact true.
Okay. Another allegation has been made that Nixon and Kissinger agreed, perhaps tacitly, to let Savak operate more freely inside the United States. Did you ever hear about sort of a tacit agreement along those lines that would let Savak operate more freely in U.S. territory?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what more freely means.
Well, I'm not really sure.
Let me just put it this way, that of course Iran was very much aware of the fact that we had CIA people in their embassy, or perhaps even not directly connected with the embassy in any overt way, and that if we were going to be very difficult about Savak presence in the Iranian embassy, then they were going to have to take a closer look at the symmetry between our embassy and their embassy and staffing. Now, sort of in that context, I can't remember any specific conversation, although I think I personally had one with the foreign minister at one stage. And I don't even remember how it came up, but I remember that there was some discussion of this. It was in that context. And there may have been other messages back and forth, and I just don't remember all the details, but yeah, it was a question that came up. But the implication of the allegation that you may have heard was that somehow or another, the so-called brutal and licentious Savak was given free rein to go out and brutalize the poor Iranian students.
Well, maybe more to keep
was nonsense.
Well, maybe the idea that there was more Savak's activities in terms of monitoring student activities might have expanded in the 70s compared to the 60s. And I don't know.
As I think I've mentioned before, the American press and public in general has given a great deal more credit to Savak's capabilities than I think any objective observation or analysis warranted. They were not omnipotent by any stretch of the imagination. I personally don't know, although it may well be that CIA did know how many Savak people were in the United States. I certainly would not want to suggest that some of these people kept tabs or tried to keep tabs on some of the more vocal Iranian student dissidents, although some of those students were getting rather long in the tooth. But anyhow, and sending back reports to headquarters that there was this demonstration or that, and these people were identified as being leaders. Sure. But that, you know, made the quantum leap from somehow or another that President and Kissinger explicitly said, you know, we know what you're doing and this is okay. No. No, I did this. Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I recall reading a book, I was visiting, there was like a quid pro quo of the U.S. let this happen in return for expansion of intelligence facilities in Iran in terms of monitoring missiles. The monitoring facilities that were already there were allowed to expand or something like that, but it doesn't make sense.
No.
Okay. Now, in the fall of 72, as the Paris peace talks in Vietnam were proceeding, the Pentagon implemented a plan called Enhanced Plus to quickly build up military strength for the Thieu regime in South Vietnam.
Right.
Under Enhanced Plus, the Shah turned over. The idea was to try to accumulate as many weapons,
right,
advanced weapons systems as possible, right, around the world to feed, right, into South Vietnam.
Right.
Under Enhanced Plus,
right,
the Shah turned over about 35 F-5 fighter planes,
right,
to the government of South Vietnam. I guess October 72,
right,
thereabouts. There's some documents that have come out about this.
Yes, I don't remember the timing, but that was certainly true. And unlike some of our other so-called allies, Iran was gratifyingly responsive to our request, and they sort of did it on faith, you might say, because we said, we need these and send them right away, and we'll get around to replacing them, in the future. I mean, there had to be some assurance that we weren't depleting at least on a very long-term basis, what they had rather painfully built up as their own military defense system. But he responded, in my view, magnificently.
Did you play any role in helping coordinate this thing from the country? You were in the country desk at this stage. Or was it more a Milk Pentagon question?
Well, I was in the loop, as the saying goes. But I remember the details. I remember what happened in the sense of the request and the response and how gratifying it was, particularly in terms of comparing it to the lack or the very slovenly response of some of the other countries that had the same kind of equipment.
Was he later compensated for the 35 jets? Or how did that work out?
I don't remember, but I have to believe that somehow or another compensation was involved. I don't think it was money. I think it was replacement.
In kind. Okay. Now, this is another question. This question relates to political opposition. In his new book on Iran, James Bill mentions a national intelligence estimate, NIE, that was produced by George Harris of the State Department's INR division in 1975. Apparently, the NIE generated some controversy because it contained a fair amount of information on the internal opposition to the Shah, the role of the clergy, and the clerical links, and links of the clergy to the secular opposition, all the National Front people and intellectuals and so forth. Do you remember much about this particular study that might have generated any discussion at the embassy or controversy at the embassy or at this time?
This particular NIE and NIEs are produced in Washington, yeah, and generally vetted there. The best that I can remember about any of these was that I insisted, or attempted to insist, from my point of from my vantage, that before any NIE was published, so to speak, that the embassy ought to have an opportunity to make a comment on it. I do not remember an NIE that suggested in any persuasive way or dealt with in any at any length the question of the Iranian clergy and its political activities. No.
Okay.
Now, it may be that there was one draft drafted back in Washington, floated him around Washington. And I never saw or discussed this, but I can't remember.
I think he suggested it went back to the embassy, and there was some criticism of a report at the embassy. But.
Well, I can remember. I can remember getting some NIEs and looking at them, not just me personally, but
the football
the embassy. And are saying, you know, that's baloney, or we certainly don't agree with this, or they're off on that as far as we're concerned, and sending our comments back. And, you know, that's just part of the process.
Okay. Okay, now some questions on economic and trade issues. At our first meeting, you mentioned the Harvard team that, with the support of the Ford Foundation, worked with the Plan Organization in the 50s and early 60s. Did the Ford Foundation have other projects that were going on in Iran during the 60s and 70s?
I vaguely recall I had some small projects, sort of standing independent projects with the Iranians. But I'm sorry, it's vague, and I might even be getting it confused with Ford in India or some other place. So I just it did not loom large in my mind.
What about other foundations like the Rockefeller Foundation? Do they have much of a presence in Iran that you can think of?
No, they're. This goes back again to the early 60s, as I recall. They did a housing project in North Tehran at the time, and I think they were involved in some construction activity other than that, but I, again, don't remember the details. But again, they didn't, it wasn't a big thing.
And also at our last meeting, you mentioned that when you were DCM, you participated in the discussions over Iran's atomic energy program. The discussions going on from, I guess, the mid-70s through 78. Who else in the embassy was involved?
Our science attaché.
Do you have the name?
Well, we had at least two.
Well, they'd be on the embassy list anyway, so I could find out them.
Yes. That was the science attaché and myself. I'm trying to remember, but I don't recall the ambassador ever really getting. I was sort of the senior point man on that. And then there were a number of people coming out from Washington.
For the AEC?
There was a. Guy in the State Department, and there may have been somebody in the AEC that was with, it was sort of a team that would come out from time to time, or the Iranians would see this team in Washington. Heavy negotiations.
Who were some of the Iranian officials that were involved in these discussions? Do you call any names of the
people? Again, I don't remember the names, but the position, of course, was the head of the Iranian Atomic Energy Commission. I don't really remember that even that was a name, but
the equivalent.
The equivalent. A couple of his deputies that I talked to. I can't recall discussing this with anybody else in the Iranian government. We dealt with them, and they seemed to have that portfolio, so there wasn't any need to really, as far as we could tell, discuss with anybody else. The question, I do remember talking with the Shah briefly about some aspect of this, or his talking to me. But it was quite short conversation, and it had to do with our policy and how they saw it or something like that.
According to some of the documents that I've seen, one of the critical issues related to nuclear proliferation. Apparently, the Shah wanted the right to reprocess spent nuclear fuel, and the U.S. wanted control over reprocessing to some extent. How was this issue handled? Do you call any of?
Well, again, there was a lot of back and forth about this and consideration of various options, alternatives. Question of whether we would reprocess, bring it back to the United States and reprocess it. Did we even have the facilities to do that? Or could we do it? Or would it be done in Europe? Would it be done under AEC auspices? And a lot of back and forth. Again, I don't remember all the details. But the basic policy issue was to be sure that this fuel was accounted for in an acceptable fashion to both sides, and there wasn't any diversion.
Do you call any other issues that were involved in this discussion besides the question of proliferation?
Well, there's always a question of the control of the fuel. I mean, from the very beginning, who was going to provide it, how it was going to be handled, where it was going to be used, how it was to be accounted for afterwards, whether it was going to be stored, reprocessed, on and on.
That was a central issue.
That was the central issue, yes.
My understanding is that the 1975 trade agreement that included the nuclear power plant program, that was announced that year, was the work of the U.S.-Iran Joint Commission, which had been created in 1974. I'm not sure about that. Because I remember in 75 there was a large trade agreement was announced that included the nuclear power plant's construction, like a multi-billion dollar trade program. Can you talk about its origins, or?
Yeah. Kissinger had the idea that, and this would apply just to Iran, but sort of a global concept, that if you developed multiple ties, skein of ties between United States and country A or a region, that this contributed to a much healthier environment, a much more secure environment, a better understanding, on and on. Insofar as Iran, I think India, several other countries are concerned, the way to go about this was to have a joint commission which would have economic components, and you would develop these various components through trade and sales and technology transfers, so on and so forth, and the commission would have experts. So this was sort of a point four program, but not funded exclusively by the United States or even manned by the United States. This would be a joint effort. There would be a counter, the joint commission would have members on both sides of equal standing and chaired. As a matter of fact, I think we had three or four cabinet level, the Secretary of State or the Minister of the Iranian Economic Finance and Economic, Hushang Ansari, whatever his position was, I've forgotten now. And we would meet one time in Washington, one time in Tehran. And this so-called trade agreement really was almost notional in that, okay, here are all the good things we hope to do. And then down to the peasants to work out the details.
Okay, between those negotiations, we're going to do power plants, which I guess would be, yeah.
Well, it was sort of under that umbrella.
Yeah. To what extent was the Joint Commission, creating a Joint Commission, I guess in 74, was set up around?
Again, I don't remember exactly.
Thereabouts, I think.
Yeah.
With a response to the problem of recycling petrodollars, the Shah's accumulating more and more American dollars from oil exports. Would the Joint Commission be a way to deal with that question by expanding
in
American
part,
commercial exports?
In part.
Yeah.
In part. I mean, obviously, we were aware of this and hope to get a good share of it one way or another. I mean, legitimately.
To what extent did the Commission's achievements live up to its original expectations?
I don't think that it lived up to it. And again, I think you have to ask, well, whose expectations? Broad general objectives, you know, were high-minded, sounded fine, but when you tried to put meat on these bare bones, it was hard going.
Let me turn this over.